Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how the federal government shutdown affected the Grand Canyon and the people who work there.
And a deep dive conversation about fat acceptance in the era of Ozempic.
But first, it has never been easy to get a visa to live in the United States. And now the Trump administration just made the bar even higher. The administration just released new guidelines directing the State Department to deny visas based on age or certain health conditions. So if you have diabetes, obesity, or cardiovascular disease, you could be denied. Basically, if you might need to rely on public benefits in the future, you might be out of luck. It's all raising concerns about untrained immigration officers making unfounded predictions about a person's future health. Here to put this news into context is Melissa Del Bosque, a longtime border reporter and co-founder of the Substack, The Border Chronicle. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
So it's always been part of the visa application process, right, to assess someone's health. Like, what's changed here, really?
Well, this is giving visa officers, you know, at the U.S. embassies this ability to deny somebody a visa just based on whether, you know, they're overweight, whether they have a heart condition or diabetes. I mean, you know, visa officers are not physicians. They're employees of, you know, the State Department. So it's quite an expansion of the powers that these visa officers are being given under this new directive.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about where this health information might go, who has access to it. Like, are there concerns about how they collect this data?
Yes. And I think there's a lot of confusion around the directive because it appears to apply to all visa applicants. But I think, you know, immigration legal experts are saying this will probably mostly impact people who are seeking like long-term permanent residency. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., they're already required to go through a medical examination and fill out forms and provide quite a lot of information about, you know, communicable diseases, their drug and alcohol use, mental health conditions, quite a bit. So this seems to be a much higher bar where just the visa officers themselves are making a determination, possibly before it even goes to a physician.
Mm-hmm. So the whole idea here, and the State Department was pretty, you know, is pretty straightforward in this guidance that they got, right? That they might not want to accept immigrants who could be basically a drain on U.S. resources in the future. I mean, I wonder, like, what information should we use or do we already use to decide who gets to be here and who doesn't?
Well, I think the current standard, so immigrants coming to the U.S. since the late 1800s have always been subject to health checks and so forth. But this new directive goes against the State Department's own foreign affairs manual, which says that, you know, visa officers can't reject people just based on what if scenarios. Mm. You know, if you're overweight, could that in the future cost the U.S. government money? These are really like, you know, what if scenarios. They're not really grounded in any type of actual data.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the broader picture here, because this is not the only thing that's happened recently that's come out of the Trump administration that restricts legal immigration, right? Like, a lot of what we talk about right now in the news in terms of immigration is a crackdown on illegal immigration. But this is making it much harder to legally migrate here. What other policies has the Trump administration put in place to make this kind of legal immigration more difficult?
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is really part of a larger plan, as you said, to restrict legal immigration to the country. Just recently, the administration announced that it would cut the number of refugees that it will admit to the U.S. to the lowest number ever since the U.S. refugee program was established in 1980. So that's just 7,500 refugees allowed to be admitted this in 2026. And for reference, in 2025, the refugee cap was set at 125,000. So it's a huge reduction in the amount of refugees that the country is going to allow in.
There are also charges now, much higher charges for people coming in on H-1B visas, right? And of course, the Trump administration has introduced this gold card, which is basically, you know, a quick path to citizenship or immigration status for people who can pay the government a lot of money.
Right. Yeah. A golden visa. Yes. So, you know, if you have millions of dollars, then you can get a pretty quick citizenship process, become a U.S. citizen. The HB1 visas, I think, is going to have a huge impact on the U.S. and Arizona, especially because it affects physicians. You know, we about 25% of our physicians in the U.S. are foreign born, and they come to train here, and then they become physicians here, and they serve, you know, rural underserved areas. And that's about one in four of the physicians we have here in Arizona. So it's going to really impact, you know, rural areas. And so that's $100,000 for a visa to bring in a foreign doctor. And that's up from a price of $2,000 to $5,000 is what it used to be. So these rural hospitals and healthcare facilities are not going to be able to afford to pay that kind of money.
Let me ask you lastly, Melissa, just what you think the long-term implications of this kind of crackdown could be. Like, if we're looking at restricting both kinds of immigration here, what does this change about what it means to live in this country, to get into this country, to be an American?
Well, I mean, you know, our universities rely on foreign scholars and researchers to come in. I think we have a reputation in this country as being innovative, of being collaborative. Universities are not going to be able to afford to bring in those scholars and researchers because of the $100,000 charge. Mm-hmm. Also with physicians, it's really going to hugely impact us, especially with general practitioners, family physicians, which are already really difficult to find among the U.S. Born population. So, you know, this is going to continue to ripple, I think, throughout our country for the next several years, as we just see fewer research studies, we see fewer physicians, fewer nurses. You know, this could impact us for many years to come.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Melissa Del Bosque with the Border Chronicle joining us. Melissa, thank you for coming back on. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
The government shutdown is over, meaning federal employees who'd been furloughed will be back to work, and those who are forced to work without pay will finally get a paycheck. But even still, it's been a tough year for the Grand Canyon. In addition to the shutdown, the summer's Dragon Bravo fire burned a North Rim landmark to the ground, and smoke was often visible from the more tourist-heavy South Rim. With me now to talk about all this is Annette McGivney, a freelance writer based in Colorado who writes often about the Grand Canyon. Annette, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Yes. Hi, Mark.
So what are you hearing from folks who work at the Grand Canyon about how it's gone for the last several weeks there?
Well, it's been very stressful for the last several weeks, which you can pile on to it being extremely stressful for, you know, since the spring or since January when Trump came into office. So the last several weeks, the employees I've talked to, some have been working without pay. Others were furloughed and at home and feeling, you know, an existential crisis in terms of wondering, you know, if they would lose their job, with threats of layoffs, with threats of not getting back pay. And so the people I've talked to that work at the park are very grateful that the shutdown is over, and they've been told to report back to work on Monday, the ones that have been furloughed. So they're grateful that the shutdown has ended.
I would imagine, though, there are also some number of employees who had to report to work, even though they maybe weren't getting paid at the park.
That's right. Yes, there were employees that were working without pay. There were even some public safety positions that initially were not getting paid, but then they started to get paid. So it was kind of chaotic at the beginning of the shutdown. But it's been like with all federal employees, it was very hard to work without pay, you know. But it was also hard to work to not work and to not be paid because they all wondered, you know, at Grand Canyon, they live there. So not only would they lose their jobs, but they would lose their housing. So, you know, it's a big deal when they feel threats of losing their jobs there.
Is there a sense that there might be damage done to the park in terms of not so much the science not being done, although I suspect that was happening, but in terms of like fewer rangers to make sure that, you know, people weren't doing things to or at the canyon that they shouldn't be doing that could damage the ecology or the ecosystem there?
Well, as far as I know, the law enforcement rangers, which those are the backcountry rangers that are patrolling to make sure that visitors are, you know, have a permit and are not, you know, starting fires and all that type of thing, they were working the whole time.
Okay.
But they have been chronically understaffed for years. And so backcountry ranger positions where people retired, those positions have not been filled. So, you know, long before the shutdown started, the rangers were really stretched and not able to cover the park the way they had like maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
Hmm. This, of course, as I mentioned, also comes not that long after the Dragon Bravo fire, which was both, it seems like it kind of took both a physical and emotional toll on a lot of folks who care about the Grand Canyon. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of the impact of the fire and then the shutdown happening, not, you know, just a few months after that was extinguished?
Yes. Obviously, there are impacts to the Grand Canyon environment and to the tourists. Business with the rim-to-rim hiking and all the outfitters that rely on that. But what happened on the North Rim with that fire was very traumatic for park employees. It was the acute trauma of when the fire happened and seeing the lodge burn, but also the homes of park employees. And that really wasn't talked about, but, you know, staff members that their houses burned to the ground. Some people feared for their lives trying to get out of that situation. So there was a lot of trauma around that. And then just the issues of the whole country kind of looking at Grand Canyon and saying, how was this allowed to happen? You know, who let this, who's in charge here? And so it was very stressful for the park, and they continue to worry about that.
Did any of the folks with whom you spoke suggest that things will get less stressful now? I mean, you mentioned that it had sort of been stressful since the beginning of the year with questions about would they get fired or laid off. Is there reason to think that things are going to get less stressful now, even though they're back to work?
Well, I think one thing that could help is one employee I talked to said, and this was 2 days ago, he said they were 10 signatures away from unionizing at Grand Canyon National Park. And that would be following what has happened in other national parks across the country. So like at Yosemite, they've unionized. Sequoia Kings Canyon has unionized. And if Grand Canyon is able to finalize that and unionize as well, they would have collective bargaining power in a way that I think would reduce the stress, maybe not for upper management, for middle and lower level positions, and they would not feel as vulnerable, perhaps, to the threats of staff cuts and, you know, during the shutdown, the threats of not getting back pay. And so I think that could be a little less stressful, but overall, the budget cuts, you know, the budget issues are not over for national parks.
Right.
The Trump administration has proposed huge, like record cuts to the national parks. And that threat is still very much alive.
Sure. Still lots to watch going forward. All right. That is Annette McGivney, a freelance writer based in Colorado. She often writes about the Grand Canyon. Annette, good to talk to you as always. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, with a little bit of finesse, almost anything can be used as a musical instrument. Even dinosaur skulls.
But first, GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy have changed the conversation around body size in a major way. For a long time, obesity was seen as a medical problem that needed to be solved, whether it was with old-fashioned diet and exercise or bariatric surgery. Then there was the dawn of body positivity and plus-size fashion and the idea that you could be happy in your body at any size. But through it all, there has also been a different kind of movement, a civil rights movement pushing for equal rights for people of all sizes. The National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance, or NAFA, was founded way back in 1969. It's a civil rights organization that advocates for things like anti-discrimination statutes and more. Today, we're going to meet their executive director, Tigris Osborne. She lives right here in the Valley, was named one of Time Magazine's 100 health leaders last year, and this year released a book she co-edited called Weight and Wisdom, all about the surprisingly long history of the body liberation movement. She came into our studios to talk about it all, beginning with her own story, and it's today's deep dive.
I can remember writing a letter to the editor of a teenage magazine to talk about like how they should be having more celebrities like the Fat Boys in their magazine. So like I was thinking about it pretty young. And then my first year in college at Smith College, I met someone who was really involved in NAFA, a woman named Carrie Hemingway, who worked at Smith and did a workshop on like fat liberation politics. I never remember the exact name of the workshop, but like literally on my 18th birthday.
So you knew about the organization for a long time, but didn't get involved until later on. What magazine was it? You wrote a letter to the editor.
It was probably Teen Magazine. I just remember, you know, there would be like these celebrity stories or whatever. And I wasn't always using the word fat to talk about myself, but I was identifying with fat people. And I really loved the Fat Boys and then later really Heavy D.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was really a teenager who was thinking a lot about Oprah and her as a role model, as a black woman, and as a smart black woman who was becoming a mogul, but also, you know, as fat representation. And I was reading all of these teen girl magazines, and so much of them were doing what we would today call diet culture stuff, right? Like, this is how you lose 10 pounds, or this is how you don't get fat, or whatever. And I was just like, but what about these cool fat people? Why aren't they in your magazine? And so I think I was in my late teens, early 20s when I discovered a magazine called BBW, Big Beautiful Woman. Wow. That was a fashion magazine for, you know, plus size fashion. And that's where I really started to see more visuals of, you know, folks who were just unafraid to be in their bodies. And I had seen that in my own life through some of my aunts who were really creative with fashion. But on the other side of my family, I'd also seen through my other aunts just sort of like a body shame and a shrinking of self-expression that is something you need to put on hold until you lose weight. So I'd had these sort of conflicting messages and images in my own personal life and in my neighborhood and in my family. And I was just looking for it every place else. You know, I really love pop culture and I was watching a lot of TV and movies and I don't know. I just started thinking about it. I don't remember ever getting an answer to that letter. So.
What did that feel like when you started to see it reflected in pop culture a little bit here and there and discovered those things?
It's exciting. I mean, it is exciting to see that representation, especially when it's authentic representation and when it's not the whole storyline. Because what we start to see is like you get fat people in TV shows, but the storyline is about how sad they are because they're fat or how what their weight loss challenge is like or whatever. And when you start to see even more, that's not that. That's just like fat people doing the same stuff everybody else does. Falling in love, having conflicts with their family, you know, trying to progress in their careers, like just doing the same things instead of being those sort of tropes, the funny fat sidekick or some kind of like weird sci-fi thing about fatness. There's a lot of weird sci-fi stuff about fatness.
Interesting.
But like it's really great to see like reflections of yourself. I think about teenage me a lot because we form so much of our identity around our bodies in those years.
Yeah.
And like what teenage me would be experiencing that's different and what teenage me would be experiencing that's the same in terms of like, you know, the stereotypes and the body ideals. And like, of course, teenagers today get so much of that through social media. But there is like a whole wave of young fat activists on platforms like TikTok that are, you know, that are speaking up for themselves.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Teenage Tigress would have been a TikToker. I wonder.
So, okay, we have to pause for a second because you're using the word fat. And
yes.
I think, you know, people are probably prickling at that, right? Because it seems like this is a word we don't use. That's rude. It's not something we talk about. This is not the case for you and for many people involved in, you know, what is now called the fat liberation movement. Talk a little bit about the terminology here and how that matters.
We use the word fat in fat activist communities and at NAFA specifically because we believe it should just be another neutral descriptor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a brunette. I have freckles. I'm fat. It doesn't have to be loaded with all the trauma that it is loaded with.
Right.
So we did that carefully in some settings because we understand that a lot of people have been traumatized by the word. But for us, it's like a balm to use it in a way that is affirming and even celebratory in some cases, because it's not something we should have to apologize for or be ashamed of. It just is. It's just another physical descriptor.
And you don't, and some people don't use words like obese, like overweight, right?
Yeah. For a lot of folks who do advocacy work for fat folks, fat communities, the medicalization of fat is considered to be one of the things that really reinforces stigma.
Hmm.
So we talk so much about fat as a medical problem to be solved and as the only, like getting rid of it as the only path to, you know, a healthful life. And we don't believe that that's true. Mm. And we believe that that has more to do with capitalist structures and selling you things to change your body than it actually has to do with health.
That's interesting. Have you had those conversations with people in the medical world, I wonder?
Yes.
I'm sure.
Yes. Both as a patient going to the doctor myself or interacting with other health practitioners, but also as an advocate, especially now that I'm the executive director of NAFA. And I have had some interesting conversations with people who consider themselves obesity experts or obesity, anti-obesity. Like their work is about sort of eliminating obesity. And many of them have never questioned that paradigm. Like, should we have ever designated this as a disease in the first place? So, and are there other ways to approach some of the places where body size and illness or medical conditions do have correlations? Not necessarily causation, but correlations.
Sure.
Are there other ways to approach managing that that don't reinforce this stigma? Because we keep hearing from the medical establishment that the more that we talk about obesity as a disease, the more we will reduce stigma because people will understand it's not your fault. NAFA is a civil rights organization.
Right.
So our stance is whatever reason you're fat, you still deserve to be treated equitably in the culture, right?
Especially within healthcare, it sounds like.
Especially within healthcare, but within employment, within housing, you know, within government policies. Like, there are all these places where we take the approach that anything we do that makes fat people's lives easier might make it easier for them to be fat. So therefore, it might be unhealthy. But there are people in all body sizes that have healthy or unhealthy habits, right? And you can't look at someone and tell something about their health or just put them on a scale and tell something about their health.
Okay, and we'll get to more about the reaction from the medical establishment to that idea in just a moment. That is Tigress Osborne, Executive Director of the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. More of our conversation after the break. And now let's return to my deep dive conversation with Tigress Osborne. She's the Executive Director of the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. So you're arguing here that you can be fat and healthy, essentially. Do you feel like that conversation is going somewhere with the medical establishment? Like you said, you have these conversations all the time. I'm sure this is like the crux of a lot of the debate maybe around this.
Mm-hmm.
Are they making progress in your mind, these conversations?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think there's sort of progress in one direction, but then there is really the GLP-1 drugs are really a juggernaut in the media. And
it's changing the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah, in the medical establishment and in the media. At the same time, though, there are increasingly more people who are questioning the obesity paradigm, and mm-hmm. more than you sometimes might think. There's a new organization called AWSOM, the Association for Weight and Size Inclusive Medicine, that is an organization for medical professionals who want to question the obesity paradigm and who want to think about weight-neutral healthcare. The Association for Size Diversity and Health, that is the Health at Every Size organization. And that organization is over 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So NAFA's 56 this year. And that organization, ASDA, is over 20 years old. So there are folks who think, like, body positivity just started 2 months ago.
Or, right. Like, right.
Or when Lizzo, right?
Yes.
And no, this stuff actually goes back decades.
Yeah.
There is this, you know, grassroots movement that's been growing the grass for decades and is still tending to the grass.
So
right?
Let me ask you about that, because that's one of the things that's so interesting about the new book and about the work that NAFA has done for a long time. You said it's how old do you say it was?
We'll be 56 this year.
56 years old. But that's not even where this all began, this quote unquote fat liberation movement, whatever maybe it was called at the time, right? Like, mm-hmm. began even before that.
Yeah, I mean, well, we like to credit the sort of individual folks, like the leadership in other civil rights movement who were fat women, especially, and especially Black women in the U.S. civil rights movement, where there were these folks who were really icons of that movement, who were people living in larger bodies. People like Fannie Lou Hamer and Johnny Coleman, who were civil rights, again, icons, that were talking about their body size as part of what they were experiencing. Mm. It predates NAFA.
So let's talk about the work that NAFA does, because it's really interesting in terms of policy, especially, I think. Like you said, it's a civil rights organization. It frames this issue in a civil rights framework. Talk a little bit about the policies that NAFA has pushed and the success that you've seen in places.
Well, we've always done advocacy in the business world and in the government. Mm-hmm. There are only 9 places in the U.S. where it's explicitly made illegal to discriminate based on body size.
9 places.
9 places. And unfortunately, Arizona is not one of those places. We may see some work on that developing soon. But the most recent and most sort of prominent win is that New York City passed a law 2 years ago to ban size discrimination in housing, public accommodation, and employment. 2 years ago, we started the Campaign for Size Freedom with our colleagues at FLAIR, which is the fat legal advocacy organization, and with some support from Dove. And, you know, Dove had this research that showed that about 34 million Americans report experiencing size discrimination every year.
34 million.
Yeah. That's like if you took the 20 biggest cities in the U.S. and everybody in those cities was experiencing this form of discrimination.
Wow.
And we also know that people tend to underreport size discrimination. Some of the things that happen that are really discriminatory, like wage discrimination based on body size, someone might not identify as discrimination. They just think about it as, like, you know, an individual unfair thing that happened, not part of, like, a thing that happens all the time.
That's so interesting, because it does affect so many people.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you lastly about the broader scope here. It sounds like a lot of work left to be done in your mind, a lot of sort of paradigm shifting. But as you mentioned earlier as well, like, a lot of that has happened at this point, even in small ways. What's next? Like, how do you incrementally make those changes? Or do you think this is something that will happen in a big way all at once?
I'm not sure if it will happen in a big way all at once, but I know that, you know, the next steps for us are to continue working through the Campaign for Size Freedom on changing some of those state laws. But also, we know that when we even attempt this legislative change, it creates more media stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the media stories can help change hearts and minds. And the hearts and minds change is what we really need, right? Because no law can actually protect you from anything ever happening to you. What's more preventative is changing mindsets around you, so that people don't want to do those discriminatory things in the first place. Mm-hmm. Or people think about making physical spaces more accessible to people in larger bodies, or making products that are for people with larger bodies, or just treating people in larger bodies with more respect. That goes, in some ways, just as far as the laws go.
Yeah.
So we're always working on that, like, narrative change, that, like, how can we show more of those examples of what fat folks are going through, and also what fat folks are overcoming.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not always the story of the discrimination. It's also the story of the joy.
The joy, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Tigris Osborne, Executive Director of the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance. Tigris, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As part of our summer series called Throwing Shade, we brought you a conversation with a reporter based in Albuquerque. She'd written about how residents of that city were deciding to ditch their evaporative coolers in favor of air conditioning, saying their swamp coolers weren't making their homes cool enough. That conversation prompted a response from my next guest, who wrote to us in defense of evaporative cooling. Mark Dix lives in downtown Phoenix and has been here since 1995. We invited him in to talk about his experience. And Mark, in your home, you have both evaporative cooling and AC. And depending on the weather conditions outside, that kind of dictates which system you use. Is that right?
Exactly. I think because of the extreme heat in Phoenix, we need to have air conditioning during certain months of the year when the dew point is high, when it's more humid, typically July and August. But the shoulder months of those hot months, which would be April, May, June, and September, October, when it's still approaching 100, but dry outside, I can use swamp cooling. And during those months, my utility bills are dramatically lower.
It requires, though, a certain amount of vigilance, right, to make sure that your house isn't getting too warm and the conditions haven't changed to the point where you need to switch between the units, right?
Correct. And that switch is not something you do multiple times throughout the day. You pretty much, when it's dry outside, I'm running that evaporative cooling up through the end of June. And then when I watch that dew point and see it's starting to rise, when the monsoon season starts, even if it's not raining, we still have monsoon season because the humidity is rising. And then I'm switching over to air conditioning.
So how big of a deal is it then to try to figure out which, like, when is the right time to switch? Like, is it a matter of you're sitting at, like, you know, you're sitting in bed and it's like, I'm a little sweaty right now. It might be time to go to the AC?
Yes. Some of it you just notice because the evaporative cooler is unable to take off 25 to 30 degrees from the outside temperature. So it would be, you know, in early July, it would be a 110 degree day and my evaporative cooler is no longer dropping the temperature down to the high 70s. Instead, it's like the temperature's in the mid 80s. Then I know that it's working too hard. And I also can just look at the weather. I see the dew point and I immediately can see that it's high and I know it's time to flip over.
What is the difference in your utility bills? And obviously, it's not an apples to apples comparison here, but what is the difference in your utility bills in those months when you're using the swamp cooler versus the months you're using the AC?
It's dramatic. The big example would be when I was digging a basement under my house 15 years ago. I was not using air conditioning because I had so many holes in my house, huge holes.
And defeats the purpose.
I would cover up those holes with plastic during the night while I wasn't working. But now I was using every power tool I owned, jackhammers, table saws, everything, using a lot of electricity, but using evaporative cooling to cool the house. And my bills were about $90 a month. I finished the basement, got it all sealed up, turned on the air conditioning, and my bills went up to $320 a month immediately. So the power pull on AC is not to be underestimated. So trying to reduce our use of air conditioning is by far the single biggest way we can reduce our energy footprint.
I can hear people right now listening to you talking about this and saying, this sounds great. I'm not sure I can sleep if it's 78, 80 degrees in May or June. So I would imagine, like, for some people like you, this works really, really well. For others, it probably wouldn't work so well.
I think it has to do with being a very different climate in your house. Evaporative cooling moves a tremendous amount of air, like high volume, through your house. So it's not windy to blow your hair back, but there's more visible air moving in your house. With AC, you don't feel the air moving. And so that is cooler in itself. Also using ceiling fans over our beds in other parts of our house is a very low energy way to stay cool. And then it's about maintaining the unit so that it is clean and running properly. And then the benefits are so great with energy savings that we end up being in a much better place and more healthy.
I would imagine also that, like, the structure of your house, how big it is, how well insulated it is, that also probably plays a role into whether or not this would be an effective cooling strategy, right?
Most definitely. Air conditioning, you can really air condition any space, be it large or small, effectively, but it's expensive. Evaporative cooling, if you're is difficult in an apartment because you don't have control of duct systems and so forth, so it would be difficult to do there. But they do have in smaller houses, if you don't want to put in the duct work, you can use a window unit, which literally is a larger version of an air conditioning window unit. That goes outside of a window, and that pushes that fresh air into your house, and then you have another window at the other end of the house that you crack open, and the air pushes through. Works very well in a small house. If you had a large ranch-style house that was very spread out, those types of houses would probably need two air conditioning units anyway. Some of them use three. Same token, you could have a swamp cooling unit on either end of the house to cover those areas.
Do you know of other people who use swamp coolers?
Only a very small number. I think it is really considered a dinosaur technology to most folks. And there's several reasons I would suspect for this. One is some of the issues we already mentioned of what people are used to. The control of a thermostat and getting that cold air is immediately. And just being able to shoulder the costs and assuming that they have no choice. Another reason, though, I think is just that the people who install air conditioning units, it's just not a profitable technology. If they're putting in a new air conditioning unit in your house, at minimum, it's going to be $10,000. And if they're selling you a highly efficient system, it could be well over $20,000. Evaporative cooling is only, you know, a couple thousand dollars to put in. And so it's less attractive to contractors. It's not something that they're going to be mentioning. And it's been deinstalled from houses much faster than it's being installed. So it's really something I think that we're going to need to return to with rising costs and a rising climate concern.
Well, along those lines, I mean, are you concerned that, you know, if it continues to get warmer here in Phoenix, let's say if, you know, 115, 120, maybe even 125 at some point is kind of a standard June or not an unusual June day, and an evaporative cooler is cooling you down 25 or 30 degrees, your house could still be close to 100 degrees.
Correct. So when you have those days that it gets up into the teens and 20s, you know, above 115, absolutely. You know, that wet T-shirt concept of the air blowing through it to cool you down, just it doesn't make as big of a difference. So that is really where air conditioning technology is. We're going to have to still have it. Definitely not saying we're done with it. Mm-hmm. It's just that we can minimize the use of it. And so those shoulder months that used to be smaller because it didn't become 100 in Phoenix until June, but if it starts to become 100 in Phoenix in April, then that's all the more reason that we can be using evaporative cooling earlier in the year and then using it later in the year approaching Thanksgiving, still knowing that we will be using air conditioning during the hottest, you know, over in the teens and higher.
Interesting. All right, Mark Dix, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So glad to be here.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Courtney Brown is a musician. She specializes in music made with new instruments. She's also a professor at Southern Methodist University, where she directs a choir that performs music using one of Brown's most innovative instruments, dinosaur skulls. It's an idea that began several years ago on a road trip. Brown was on her way to ASU to pursue a degree in digital media and performance, and as she told our co-host Sam Dingman, she made a fateful pit stop.
Yeah, so we stopped by Tucumcari at the Mesalands Dinosaur Museum, and they had an exhibit with the sound of a Parasaurolophus. So you could press a button, and then you heard the sound. To me, this was amazing, and you know, I realized that dinosaurs could be singers, and I'm a singer, so I felt like I understood them in a way I hadn't before.
Yeah, yeah. Well, could you describe the sound?
Well, it was this deep, low, resonant sound. What they did was just model the sound coming through the Parasaurolophus's crest. It has this long crest that scientists believe was used for sound resonation.
This experience clearly stuck with you because now you have started this dinosaur choir at SMU, where members of the choir create sounds by blowing into replica dinosaur skulls via a small tube. Talk a little bit about moving from hearing this sound and thinking about dinosaur sounds in kind of a new way to wanting to replicate them.
Well, we take CT scans of dinosaur skulls, and then once you separate the anatomy in the CT scans, then you have this skull, which is often like part of it can be crushed or deformed. And so you have to go through this process of undeforming it. We call it retrodeformation. And then we print it on PLA plastic printers. And so then to create the actual sound, I basically find bioacoustical models of bird syringes, so bird vocal boxes. So basically I take a set of mathematical equations that describe how sound pressure is transformed by motion of the vocal cords. And then I code that so that it creates sound in real time.
Are you using that approach to modeling the sound because the structure of the skulls suggests that that would be the closest analog to what these dinosaurs would have sounded like?
That's a good question. So dinosaur vocalization is extremely controversial right now. But in 2023, Junki Yoshida, among others, released a paper where they identified the first dinosaur larynx, an ankylosaur, which is a distant relative of the dinosaurs that I work with. And so I use that as an inspiration.
So could you describe for us the sounds that come out of these dinosaur skulls when you and your fellow members of the choir blow into them? Because, you know, I think a lot of people listening to this maybe haven't even considered what dinosaurs sounded like. But if they have, I'm guessing it's somewhat like me, where they imagined, you know, like the T-Rex in Jurassic Park, like roaring. And that's not the type of sound that you and the choir are making.
Right. So the later models, I'm using a model of a dove coo. So it's based on a dove. But it's more like a rounded sound, but like lower. The larger that archosaurs are, so birds and crocodiles and dinosaurs are archosaurs, they tend to do a lot of closed mouth vocalization. And so that's like kind of an aspect. Of course, we're the sound is coming out through the nose if it's being resonated through the nasal passages.
What do we know, if we know, about whether or not dinosaurs were musical in their sound making, or how they used sound to communicate, and how similar do you think the sounds that your skulls make are to that sound making?
Okay, so this is a sticky question, and first I'm going to say that my specialty is music and computer science. I do work with a paleontologist, but I will say that we know about the anatomy and some traces that dinosaurs have, but vocalization is a behavior. And so even if we did find the anatomy, it's like hard to say how we would determine what that behavior was. I mean, we know that birds sing, dinosaurs are related to birds. And we know that alligators make sounds and crocodiles make sounds at each other. But we actually don't know for sure that dinosaurs made sound at all. So I am using biological models of a bird and then speculating. It's really about letting your imagination fill in the gaps where there's very little data.
Yeah. As you were describing the combination of scientific backdrop and, you know, unknown behavior of dinosaurs, the phrase that came to my mind was speculative fiction, except that you're making music instead of, you know, writing a story.
Yeah. It's hard to say, like, what is authentic or what is not authentic, what is accurate and what is not accurate. I have information. I mean, I took measurements and I'm using biological data, but I'm also filling in a lot of things I don't know.
Yeah. Tell me what's exciting to you about that as an artist and as a musician. What do you think is exciting about playing in that speculative space?
I would like to connect with the impossible. It's about how we are like empathic with another creature Like at the core of it, it's like, well, if a dinosaur is a singer, then in some way, I understand that dinosaur, that like reading about it or seeing something doesn't hit me in the same way. I play a musical instrument and I have this experience that this instrument becomes a part of me.
Yeah.
So if I work with this dinosaur and I play this dinosaur instrument, then in a sense that dinosaur also becomes a part of me. Mammals rose because the dinosaurs died. It opened all these, you know, niches that the mammals filled and eventually gave rise to us. In a sense, they're a part of us, you know, in the ecology of life.
Yeah.
And to me, I think that's important.
Yeah. Well, Courtney Brown is an associate professor in creative computation at Southern Methodist University and the creator of Southern Methodist University's Dinosaur Choir. Courtney, thank you for this conversation.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right, Dinosaur Choir will take us out on this Thursday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow with much more. Mark's got lots to talk about on the Friday newscap. And don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show.
For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.